Welcome to Perspectives on Public Interest. I'm Emily Sutcliffe from Penn Law's Toll Public Interest Center, and I'm so pleased that we're joined today by David Daly. David is the former editor-in-chief of Salon and the author of Rat Fucked, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. He's now the publisher and CEO of Connecticut News Project. David, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Emily. It's nice to be on a podcast where you can actually say the title of my book.
Well, we kind of debated about that, and we decided to go for it. So, first of all, can you tell us a bit about your career path, kind of how you got where you are now, and is this where you imagined you'd be?
Sure. I was that kid in the backseat of a car who was designing newspapers in the, you know, in second grade. Was a kid who always loved to do the junior high school paper, the high school paper, the college paper. I was inspired very early on when my parents let me stay up way too late one night and All the President's Men was on TV, the story of how Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein kind of uncovered the Watergate scandal and brought down a president. And really from that day forward, I didn't have that much doubt in what it was I wanted to do. You got a sense of the power and possibility of journalism and what it offered you as far as the ability to bring issues to attention, to bring voices out, the ability to on any day ask a question of most anybody, and that excited me greatly.
So then getting to your book, kind of following that journalistic trajectory, what was the impetus for writing it?
Well, I had a question. The book really started when I didn't understand how in 2012 Barack Obama gets reelected president with a fairly big electoral college majority over Mitt Romney. The Democrats take back the U.S. Senate, but they can't budge the House of Representatives, which stays under Republican control, 201. And I didn't understand why that didn't move along with the White House and the Senate. I got even more confused when I looked at the aggregate vote totals and realized that Democrats got 1.4 million more votes nationwide, and that still wasn't enough. So I wanted to try to figure out why and what happened. And as I asked those questions, I learned about a plan called Red Map that was orchestrated by something called the Republican State Leadership Committee, and that they had sort of undertaken this really specific and audacious, some might even call it diabolical, political strategy that reinvented redistricting and gerrymandering. It was a very specific strategy to try to flip control of state legislative districts. They focused on fewer than 120 of them. They spent just $30 million, and they flipped chambers in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina, Wisconsin, blue states, purple states, the swing states, and took control of all branches of the government in a really important year, because 2010 is a redistricting year. Every 10 years, we redraw all of the lines in the states, and in 41 of the 50 states, it's the state legislatures that then in turn draw the congressional districts. So there is a lot of power there, and it sounds really boring. It sounds like the stuff that put us all to sleep in civics class in eighth grade. But this is where the Republican comeback began. This is the reason why you see the kinds of politics and policies you do coming out of states like North Carolina, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And this is the reason why you have an entire government at the federal level and at the state level that is controlled by one party at a time when we are essentially a 50-50 country. And these lines are that important, and we have to pay that close attention to them.
So I think a lot of people are familiar with the terms gerrymandering and redistricting. My sense is that when you get into kind of the nitty-gritty of what's at stake and what it looks like on the ground, people often don't know. So can you give us a really realistic view of what's at stake here when we gerrymander?
Sure. Essentially, when what you are seeing right now in states that have been gerrymandered in the way that they have is that you have Democrats often getting more votes or essentially tying. So in the state overall, it's about a 50-50. But because of the way that the lines are drawn, Republicans often have veto-proof supermajorities. They are able to do this. There are essentially two ways of gerrymandering. There's packing and there's cracking. The idea of packing is to take as many of the other party's votes as you can and to cram them into one district that they win overwhelmingly. The other idea is cracking, which is to divide them up in such a way that they are kind of an inconsequential number in districts that they can't actually win. This has never been so easy because of the technological advances, even between 2000 and 2010 when this was done. And this is why I think so many people don't understand, especially in my line of work, how the 2010 redistricting cycle differs from every other one. Folks love to say, oh, gerrymandering has been around forever. It's not that big of a deal. Both sides do it. The technical precision and the amount of information that is available about us that these map makers have on their computers when they are drawing these lines is so specific and surgical and precise that we can be carved up within, you know, an inch of our lives, essentially. They use a program called Maptitude in most states that comes preloaded with the census. So you've got kind of all of the incredible demographic detail that's in the census, whether it's ethnic information, economic information, all kinds of things. You can then add on to that all of the public record databases. So voting records, what year did people vote? Precinct level results of these elections that can essentially tell you on one street how it went. You can load in magazine subscriptions, cable subscriptions, social media likes, consumer preferences that you can get for pennies. And it's incredibly powerful and quick and surgical, the ability that these map makers have. I would just say quickly that what people need to understand is that there is a serious connection between the way that these lines are drawn and the kinds of policy outcomes you see on the other side. So when North Carolina passes a transgender bathroom bill, when Michigan passes an emergency manager, a bill that leads to the water crisis in Flint, when Michigan and Wisconsin pass limits on collective bargaining, when Ohio says, no, Cleveland, a city cannot raise the minimum wage on its own, when Ohio says you can't have an abortion after 6 weeks, all of these decisions come from gerrymandering. All of this starts with the way that the lines are drawn, with the kinds of people that these districts can elect, and with the lack of any effective veto mechanism on top of that. And the only thing that I would add super quick is that all of the voter ID and the voter suppression laws, the limits on early voting, the limits on absentee balloting, so much of this also flows from gerrymandering. The first thing that many of these legislatures do once they take power is limit who gets to vote and how.
Thank you. And I think many people kind of think of Big Brother and evoke that thinking of the government and completely bypassing the electoral system itself. And so that's what I found really powerful about your book. It kind of shows this in a completely new entry point. Since we're in Pennsylvania, another thing I learned from your book was Pennsylvania had a really unique role in the 2010 redistricting situation. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Pennsylvania has one of the largest lower houses in the country. I believe it's 203 members. And it was essentially at the Democrats had control in 2008, and the Republicans were trying to flip it in 2010. It was a one-vote edge for the Democrats. So Republicans targeted six specific lawmakers at the state house level. So folks in Washington ran focus groups and said, which legislators are we most likely to be able to beat and how can we run against them? They chose these six small towns across Pennsylvania. They won the majority of them, and they won these races by sending in hundreds of thousands of dollars of sort of misleading political mailers into these towns every single day for weeks leading up to Election Day. Hundreds of thousands of dollars of negative ads drop in local races in the last 4 to 6 weeks of a campaign. It left these incumbents no time to recover or respond or to raise the kind of money that they would have needed to counter it. They never saw it coming. In Pennsylvania, one of the things that they used was the idea of an Arlen Specter library. Arlen Specter had been a longtime Republican senator from the state who, at the very end of his career, switched parties. He was not the most popular man in the state by the end of his career. There was a really limited amount of money in the state capital budget for a library where his papers would be stored after he left office. I think the reality was it was like $1.4 million. The Republicans who came up with the campaign against him used the entire amount of the capital budget and said that these state lawmakers were building a $500 million shrine to Arlen Specter, and ran all these guys out of town. I went out and interviewed a bunch of them, and they'd been running in these towns for years. They knew their neighbors. They'd been door knocking in these towns a long time. They would show up and people would hand them these flyers and just be like, can you explain to me why you voted for a $500 million library for Arlen Specter in the middle of this tough economy? You know, I didn't do that is not the best excuse. And it's, you can only explain to the people who you're able to reach. You're not going to do a television buy in those markets. So it was a really, really effective ad. Republicans went. I took over both houses of the legislature here. They had the governorship, so they had complete control of the redistricting process in 2011. They drew themselves incredibly friendly districts that have locked in control for themselves ever since. You see how effective these maps are. The first election that is run on them is 2012, and Pennsylvania elects a slate of 13 Republicans and 5 Democrats for Congress. Again, it's a blue state. It's like, well, this is really interesting. In 2008, which is a very similar year to 2012, Barack Obama wins Pennsylvania by a similar margin in both years, and Democrats running for the House of Representatives win the aggregate vote total in both years by a very similar number. In 2008, the Democrats take 12 of 19 seats. In 2012, Republicans take 13 of 18 seats. What changes in the middle? The lines that were drawn for these new congressional districts. And it's been 13-5 ever since. It didn't change in 2014. It didn't change in 2016.
It seems like 2020 is our next chance for change, if I'm understanding correctly. And I've heard you say in the past that the Democrats have just not historically and are not presently focused on districts and gerrymandering. You said even Bernie kind of doesn't seem to focus on that enough. So why? Why are they overlooking something that, again, kind of seems like an obvious cause to a lot of their failed elections?
It's a great question. The small D democracy agenda you would think would be a good thing for the Democratic Party. In all of the debates between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, there was no talk of gerrymandering. There was no talk of the Voting Rights Act. All of these things which ought to be essential to how the Democratic Party moves forward. I mean, Hillary Clinton, after all, won by 3 million votes in the popular vote. When people vote, the Democrats win. You would think that the Democrats would want to be sure that it's not only good politics, it's good democracy. When people are registered, when people turn out, when the process is fair. The Democrats got caught asleep at the switch in 2018. I'm not sure that they realized exactly how much trouble they were in until the following year, when these maps were drawn and they realized they were nearly impossible to win on. What you have seen as a result is a hollowing out of the party at all levels. It affects your ability to run candidates going forward. You don't have a base when you don't have folks kind of working their way up through the system. These districts are so uncompetitive that in North Carolina this last year, 57 of 120 House seats went uncontested. In Georgia, it's even higher. It's 80%. In Ohio, it's a third of these seats. In Wisconsin, it's almost half. You can't even get a bad candidate who wants to run on these lines because they are hopeless. The Democrats have woken up a little bit. I mean, Eric Holder and President Obama have made this a real priority heading into 2020. I think that they need to be careful that they're not again fighting the last war. If what they want to do is run a blue map version of red map, it's not likely to be effective because they have to win on these maps without the element of surprise that the Republicans had working for them last time. The Republicans are going to be waiting with plenty of money. And I think that these maps are daunting. I mean, there's a super majority in North Carolina. There's a super majority in Wisconsin. It's the biggest Republican majority in the assembly there since the 1950s. The idea that this can be unwound on these maps in two election cycles is daunting, and I don't mean to be overly pessimistic, but I think it's foolish not to be really aware of what the challenges are. Since the Democrats did not make bigger gains in 2016, I almost think that 2020 is a lost cause. The only hope I see, if I'm looking at this as a Democratic Party strategist, would be a handful of governor's races in 2018 in all of these key states, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Democrats are not going to have the legislature. They will not be able to draw the lines in those states. Republicans are likely to be doing that. If the Democrats can capture the governor's mansions in these states, they will have veto power over the maps. They could get less bad maps. The maps will probably still favor Republicans, but perhaps not, 13-5 in Pennsylvania. Perhaps it favors them. You're making me do math. On the fly, 11-7.
On Election Day, you wrote an article, right? You published an article titled Hillary Clinton
Will
Win.
Yeah, I was wrong.
Yeah.
That was a bad article.
I mean, your point was...
Somebody take that down.
Your point was still that the GOP would have control of Congress and that
yes.
It's baked in for years. Mm-hmm. So I think kind of the theme that you've been on is very much in that article. So don't be so hard on yourself. But my question is really...
I would like to take the first paragraph and lop it off. The last two-thirds stands.
Exactly. So my question is, were you shocked by the outcome of the election?
Yes.
Okay. And how have you been processing that since November?
Red wine. I did not imagine, and I don't think the Clinton campaign or any of the pollsters or lots and lots of people imagined what was going to happen in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan. I never imagined that those states would turn. It seemed to me, writing that piece the weekend before the election, that Trump needed to pull such an inside straight that it was just about impossible to do. And, I mean, it's one of the amazing stories of our time that he was able to pull it off. in a way, this is the goal of REDMAP. The goal of REDMAP was twofold. It was to be able to push conservative legislation through states because it was easier to get things done in states than it was in Washington, which was gridlocked because you had a Democratic president. And then the hope was that they would be able to keep control of Congress through 2020 and that they would have three elections to put a Republican in the White House, in which a point in time they would move on an agenda that they would not be able to get through otherwise, and that they would have a shot at that in 12, 16, and 20. There's, you know, a famous story about, Grover Norquist, who's the big conservative activist, a big anti-tax activist in D.C., who, talking at the Conservative Political Action Conference in 2012, talking to a lot of conservatives who were unexcited about Mitt Romney, and he was like, listen, guys, we don't need a visionary president. All we need is a president, he said, with enough working digits to handle a pen, because they intend to run policy out of the Speaker of the House's office. And it's not as if Mitt Romney would have vetoed that stuff. He would have signed it. He's like, we have the policy agenda here. This is what we're going to pass. So it doesn't matter who is in the White House as long as it's a Republican who will let this legislation through. And what you're going to see on the tax side, on the social side, on the economic side, on the judiciary side, on the regulation side, on the environmental side, on immigration, on an entire slew of issues is going to be, I think, a bright red legislation. And the question becomes whether there's any of these issues that Trump will stand up to them on. He has said that he would probably get in the way of kind of wackiest Paul Ryan ideas on Social Security and Medicare. But it's going to be uncharted waters, and I think what scares me about it is that this has happened without the ability of voters to check it at the ballot box. This kind of extreme agenda is going to be pushed by parties that can't carry bare majorities often. A president is going to be signing this legislation into law after losing by 3 million votes. A Congress that is radically gerrymandered is going to be pushing these bills through, and there's not a whole lot we can do about it.
So in a sense, right, Tocqueville says tyranny of the majority feels like we have a tyranny of the minority right now.
I think that's exactly right, and I think that it's been a deliberate strategy to govern from the minority.
In light of all of that heaviness, a lot of folks are feeling great angst and not a lot of optimism for the future. But to turn that around, kind of, what are your thoughts on what hope lies ahead, what we can all do, regardless of party lines, but to ensure that our country is a safe place for everyone to prosper? And
that's a great question. I mean, hope is a little hard to come by. I think that if there is hope on the gerrymandering front, it lies in a handful of court cases that are making their way through the system that could finally bring some needed balance and sanity back. The courts have for years resisted the idea of weighing in on partisan gerrymandering, but there's a case now out of Wisconsin in which they will have sort of a statistical measure that a handful of justices have asked for over the years, and said that if they could be shown a justiciable standard to identify partisan gerrymandering that has gone too far, they'd be open to it. So this case attempts to give them one with something called the efficiency gap, to kind of measure the ways in which votes have been intentionally wasted in the process of drawing lines. So if we could get that kind of standard, it would make a big difference heading towards a 2020. It would have been a lot easier had a spot on the Supreme Court been filled last year instead of this year, because we'll see a much different person. It's aimed at Justice Kennedy, so in some ways the hope of the Republic lies with you, sir.
All right, well, that's all the time we have. David, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's been an
absolute
pleasure.
Having me.
And thank you to our listeners. You can find David's book on Amazon, and his new endeavor, the Connecticut News Project, can be found at ctmirror.org.
This podcast was produced by the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Learn more about public interest lawyering at law.upenn.edu/public service. Thanks for joining us.